Subcommittee of the Subcommittee of Public Safety to order. I know we still have people running around in various parts of the building and at caucuses, so they will filter in as we begin. We were going to start off today by the OIA giving us an overview, but I think until the rest of the members get here, we'll do that at the end. So we're going to go ahead and open up the public testimony for today. Steve Dole and Rick O'Dell. And we're going to, and just so everyone knows, we're going to try and move through the testimony today, if we can get there. But we would like to have people keep their testimony concise. I know there's a lot of people with similar programs here, so please be additive instead of repetitive. So, thanks. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I am president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. I am also a member of Parents of Murdered Children. I am here today to testify against this budget. And the reason I say against it is because, quite frankly, it's not good enough. It's not enough. You know, as I tried to put together some remarks for today, I found a file in my desk last night that went back to 1994. And it was the genesis for the Oregon Youth Authority. It started out at the counties with county delegations, of which I was on one of those, on the Multnomah County delegation. And it wound up in this summit that they had in Eugene, which was the precursor to the putting together the task force and the legislation to create Senate Bill 1, which created the Oregon Youth Authority. I thought about a lot of different comments I could make, and I don't necessarily like to do this, but I think it's going to be worthwhile for you. I want to read to you something, and because I want it in the record. Just inside the main administration building at McLaren School is a plaque that reads, State Board of Control, 1925, Walter Pierce, Governor. That plaque reflects a time when McLaren was a place for runaways, small-time thieves, and other delinquents. Profanity, drinking liquor, smoking tobacco, and truancy were deep concerns of the times. The juvenile justice system then is the same juvenile justice system of today, only the crimes have changed. Today we are talking about arson, assault, murder, distribution of illegal drugs, rape, robbery, and sex abuse. Meeting a 13-year-old with over 60 arrests, the most recent for carrying a loaded weapon. Talk to him and you will soon learn that he has no values, no respect for human life. You will find yourself agreeing with the McLaren staff member who says he's going to kill someone someday. Meet another young man at McLaren who can spout out all the latest anger management jargon. Ask him why he's there. He'll tell you that his girlfriend made him mad, so he stabbed her in the chest until she died. Tragically, these cases are not uncommon and are quickly becoming typical. While adult crime rates have remained fairly constant in recent years, the rate of violent crime committed by juveniles increased more than 80% between the years of 88 and 92. And it's not just the volume of juvenile crime that has changed. The type of crime has changed also. What has not changed is our juvenile justice system born at the turn of the century. As it stands, our juvenile justice system wastes lives and it wastes resources. From the courts to detention centers, from police agencies to training schools, the system is swamped with young offenders. Crimes ranging in degree from shoplifting to auto theft go unpunished. Even violent offenders regularly get away with little or no time in custody. Often those offenders are placed in treatment programs intended for young people with less serious problems. Those who might have benefited but now must go without. And the worst of it, young juvenile offenders new to the system are ignored. Right now, there are no consequences for unlawful actions. There is no certainty of punishment. There is no accountability. The result, an escalation of offenses until the conduct is so outrageous that the system is forced to respond. Is it any wonder that young criminals consider the system a joke? Is it any wonder that Oregonians are fed up? How did we get into this mess? Juvenile Corrections is the orphan of both our child welfare and criminal justice systems. Adult Corrections is a separate department with vocal advocates for its programs. Juvenile Corrections is an administrative section within the Children's Services Division within the Department of Human Resources. Whenever a choice is made about resources for adult corrections, child welfare, or juvenile corrections ends up at the bottom of the list. I would never deny the value and importance of child welfare services. Early intervention and prevention programs are critically important, with literally hundreds of champions and advocates for continued and enhanced resources. But who is the advocate for the bad kid? Collectively, we have avoided being advocates for those young people who took the wrong fork in the road because they represent failures. Failure by parents, families, by programs, our social institutions, failures by all of us. These failures result in fears. People are afraid of these young criminals, and rightfully so. Whether adult or juvenile, a person who commits rape, murder, armed robbery, or some other serious crime needs to be locked up. Citizens have every right to expect their personal safety is just as important as a juvenile's welfare. I have every confidence that we can meet that expectation, but we can break the cycle of violence. We can and should devote our energy and our resources to keeping kids from getting into trouble in the first place. But before we can do that, we must fix a system that has suffered from years of neglect. I believe these proposals give us the opportunity to make a difference, the opportunity to correct our mistakes, and the opportunity to restore the public's confidence in our juvenile justice system and our ability to solve problems together. That was the Governor's Task Force report in 1994. Attorney General Ted Kulongoski, now Governor Kulongoski. Those are his words, and I'm going to submit that as part of the record. It pains me, after the work that I have seen people put into creating the Oregon Youth Authority, it pains me to see what we're doing to it today. I wonder if we had but one piece of government to fund. If I told you that's the only thing you could do is fund one piece of government, which piece of government you would fund? I would hope it would be public safety. Because when you analyze it, it's the one and only part of government that government absolutely has to do that we could not in any way leave up to any other entity, public or private sector or otherwise. What I see here is actually, in the words of Yogi Berra, is deja vu all over again. In 1985, the system got capped. We went down to about 370 beds. We went down to 370 beds, then the system was capped at about, I think it was between 517 and 522 in the late 80s, early 90s. During that same time, as I expressed and was expressed in the preamble to that report, the juvenile crime rate, the violent juvenile crime rate went up 80% because the message was out there to the kids, and the kids understood the message. It was, again, stated, if you read in that report, it's all there. It's a joke. Because the judge says, next time, Billy, we're going to send you away. But you know what? Next time never came. Next time never came because there was no room at the inn. Now, there's two very sad entities around that. One is, for every one of those kids that didn't end up at the inn, there was a victim. And I'll shorten this down because I know some of you heard it before, but I have to tell you that my daughter was one of those victims. What some of you don't know and don't realize, however, is that the 16-year-old that murdered her had thrown a brick through a plate glass window where there was a human being standing on the other side of it, an elderly human being who, by the grace of God, wasn't decapitated, took pipe bombs to school, lit fires in school lockers, lit cats on fire, used ligature to pull limbs off of small animals, And you know what? Never saw the inside of an institution. 2 weeks to the day before he murdered Lisa, he tried to attack his own father with a blunt instrument. Excuse me, it was his stepfather, but it was the only father he ever knew because his father died when he was less than a year old. But he tried to attack him with a blunt instrument. Luckily, the police were there at the time and stopped him. In today's world, or at least up till to now, he probably would have seen the inside of McLaren or one of the facilities with the kind of behavior he was exhibiting. But then it wasn't happening because we were capped, not due to budgetary reasons, but because of philosophical reasons. Because of people like Rick Bauman and Dick Springer, and I could name a bunch of them to you, who decided that we should just keep kids in the community. That after all, they're just kids. Yeah, they do bad things, but they're kids. So now, obviously, we're faced with budgetary concerns. I'm against this thing because I believe that it's your first duty to fund public safety. It's your first duty to protect the citizens. And in fact, refer to Article 1, Section 15 of the Constitution, and the people in 1996 through Measure 26 made that part of the Constitution. Protection of the public. It wasn't there before. For $16 million, you can reopen Warrenton and Oak Creek for $16 million. You can take the eastern facilities and you can turn them over to the DOC. They're going to need space and they can turn those into adult facilities. And then when this economy returns someday, and it will, we're not going to be here forever, I would suggest to you that you put a spade in the ground at McLaren where you won't have to do any siding, you won't have to buy any new property, you won't have to build infrastructure, it's all there, and you build 325-bed facilities. They'll be more easy, they'll be more easily managed, more efficient to manage, and more streamlined by putting them on that property that's there. I'm going to, I know you're, there's no way I can say everything I want to say here today, and I know there's other people here that want to testify, but, and this is tough for me to say, but if we can't for whatever reasons, political or otherwise, do the tough things around cutting in this building, and I know there's been some cuts made, and I appreciate that, and believe me, I don't envy you your jobs. But if we can't take on the big cuts, if we can't sell safes, if we can't get rid of a Department of Economic Development that has given us the worst employment rate and one of the worst economies in the country, believe me, I worked in the private sector for big corporations. If that Department of Economic Development was part of the companies that I worked for, that division would be gone. I know that would be. If we can't do that, folks, and I don't like saying this because, quite frankly, besides being head of Crime Victims United, I'll just say it, I'm a Republican, then maybe we got to raise revenues. Because if you can't take the big ones, we got to come up with some money to make sure that people's lives and their property are protected. I'll end it with saying this. My daughter was, when she was murdered, she was walking home from school in mid-afternoon. And I talked to a friend of mine the other day, and we were talking about a lot of things, and we were talking about the budget situation. And this guy's an educated guy. And he said to me, you know, my kids' education is important to me, but he said if they have to cut 4 days out of their school year versus making sure that they keep juveniles and adults who are dangerous locked up, he says, I'll figure a way to make up that 4 days for them. And I think that said it all. Education, I know, is important, but believe me, if you're not safe, if you're not protected, none of this other stuff makes any difference. Great roads, great educations, great everything. Because you see, my Lisa will always be frozen in time at 12 years old. She'd be 23 this May 1st, and she never got that education. She will never have that marriage. She will never have those children or that career. Thank you very much.
Steve. Mr. O'Dell.
I appreciate the opportunity to address the Public Safety Subcommittee today regarding proposed further cuts to the integrity of public safety regarding juvenile offenders. My name is Rick O'Dell, and I've worked with chronic juvenile offenders for over 20 years. I'm the program manager of Joe R.J. Boys Ranch, a residential treatment program for boys 13 to 18 years of age. We've exhausted all resources in their communities. We are a statewide resource and serve all Oregon counties. I, too, was a member of the a committee on the governor's task force back in the early 90s, and I am against the current budget and think that anything less than funding that was indicated through Senate Bill 1 is not enough. For all... I'll be very brief here. In my handout, I think, is the most important thing I wanted to pass on to y'all. For all offenders, the juvenile justice system represents an expression of the community's values. When decisive early intervention is combined with meaningful treatment, the justice system is a responsible model for community values. When crime is ignored, minimized, or diverted, however, juvenile offenders see the response of government for what it is, an impotent, half-hearted, unconvincing attempt at accountability. In my experience, what works is a system of coerced treatment and convincer punishments. To put it in real-world perspective, what would happen to tax collections in this state if the only sanction for delinquency was a diversion program and competence classes? Continued slashing of public safety programs is taking away the credible or else required in treatment to get offenders to look at the impact of their behavior on others. To quote Rick Hill, former OA director, public safety is a fundamental right of citizens. No matter how lean the state budget, the single most essential service we should expect from the government is public safety. And that's all I have to say. Included in your handout is some actual case histories from kids in my program. And what's important to note is what I've listed on top here is that chronic juvenile offenders in the community are caught for only a small portion of the damage they do. They're extremely prolific. And listed below, you can see, as part of their treatment program, they have to list... The clarify and admit to offenses they committed prior to placement and that they were not caught for. And I think those speak for themselves, and I hope you'll take a look at those. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Dell. Questions for Mr. Dole or Mr. O'Dell?
Mr. Chair, I just want to confirm the date of the report from Attorney General Kulongoski.
1994, September of 1994.
Thank you.
One thing, if I could, Mr. Chairman, on the second handout I gave you, I failed to mention. You'll find that there is attached to that handout a list of the releases, right, that have been done and the crimes committed by those juveniles. And you can see by looking through that we're hardly talking about juveniles who have done graffiti, kicked over gravestones, or popped hubcaps. These are serious offenses, but the thing I want to point out to you is this. That is the tip of the iceberg. If you will just go through that list, pick out five and take their JGIS numbers and run those numbers, what you'll find is what Mr. Odell just described to you. You will find juveniles who have 10, 20, 30 referrals and offenses before they landed in McLaren for that crime that you're looking at there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Or J-Bar J for that matter.
Thank you, Mr. Odell. Thank you. Mr. Dole. We have a next group up will be the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. It's Mike Valter, Emma Dennis, Gary Hansen, and Arnie Green. If you have handouts and want to testify, can you go ahead and bring those up and put them up here, and then we'll have the staff get them. Otherwise, she was running around and she's trying to take notes as well, so we would certainly appreciate it. Mr. Valter?
Yes, I'm Mike Valter. I'm the director of the Boys and Girls Aid Society of Oregon. Each of us will introduce ourselves individually in the agencies we represent. I just wanted to give you three simple points that represents the position of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. It's a 33-member alliance of children's agencies, provides 200 programs to children in every community of Oregon. Three simple points. One, I think the Oregon Youth Authority has presented you with the notion of a continuum of care. For us, that's the notion of a system, that there has to be something in the system for all the young people in all the stages, from incarceration to prevention. We're encouraging that notion be retained regardless of the reductions that are necessary. Secondly, I don't know how to emphasize this, but the notion of having the public safety cuts and holding the Department of Correction harmless at the cost of the Oregon Youth Authority, we think is ill-advised, and that the disproportionate reduction in Oregon Youth Authority, we think, is ill-advised. And we strongly encourage you, if you have to hold the Department of Corrections harmless, that you look at distributing those reductions across state agencies rather than focusing them on Oregon Youth Authority. And that's our understanding. And lastly...
Where have you received that understanding?
Huh?
Where have you received that understanding?
When you look at the magnitude of the reductions, how would you have those if there was, 40% reductions, some of those that are potential in these conversations,
I think. I want to tell everyone for the audience's sake, no reductions have been made as of yet. So that's why we're here, to hear about the public safety system as a whole. And this chairman does not want to send that message to anyone out there in the public safety community, that we're using the governor's recommended budget as a model at this point in time, at least for looking at some things, but no reductions.
It's the only starting point we have.
I understand.
And then thirdly, I think the notion that, I think this you'll probably hear over and over again, is that as you make cuts of these sizes, you're not going to avoid increased crime. That just, they go together. I'm now going to make my presentation from the Boys and Girls Aid Society. Again, you've got my written testimony, so I'll try to keep this brief. We're a 117-year-old agency. We were chartered in Oregon in 1885. I've been there a little less than from the founding. I've been there 17 years and have seen the progress of this kind of decision-making over that 17 years, and saw the level of juvenile crime increase during the recession in the 80s. Saw it again in that period of time that Mr. Dole referred to in the 90s. And one of the cautions that I would have for this panel is that as you reduce services to this population of young people, what happens is there's an increase in the rate and the pace of crime, but it will overwhelm you because you've eliminated infrastructure. And that infrastructure, as you eliminate it, cannot be replaced as quickly as the rate and pace of crime, and you'll face yourselves in a short period of time, probably 3 to 5 years, with a juvenile crime crisis. I think all you have to do is look back at those two periods, look at the recessionary period before it, watch the increase in crime until it reaches a crescendo, because of the 200 programs that we operate that is part of the system, a number of those will close under these size of reductions. I mean, and that's not news to you. I mean, you know that you're closing services, and we're not pretending that we're the only outfit that's happening to. There will be a consequence that you can't replace these, because some of them will be facilities. They'll be buildings, and those won't sit idle. They will be put to some other use, because agencies will close and they'll sell those buildings off. This period of time in trying to site a new facility is very, very difficult, as you know, as you've tried to site your own facilities. So there's a caution here in how deeply you make these cuts. I think the last item I'd make, and it is in that reference to this sense of disproportional cut, is that the rape by a 16-year-old or a 35-year-old really doesn't matter. If your car is stolen by a 15-year-old or a 40-year-old, it really doesn't matter. If you're assaulted by someone, you're assaulted by someone. So we're thinking that you need to look at a balanced approach in your public safety endeavors and make sure that your juvenile system has the ability to respond and respond in a timely fashion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Chairman Pardrich and members of the committee, my name is Emma Dennis, and I'm here to talk about what basically we think works in the community as well. And I'm the executive director at St. Mary's Home for Boys in Beaverton, and we are a community agency providing services to OYA. Presently, we have 21 adolescents. The average age is 15. They come to us with a long history of mental illness, abuse, neglect, school failures, violence, prior placements into psychiatric hospitals and foster care and shelter placements. They're adjudicated for serious offenses, and as Steve has talked about, sexual abuse, molestation, fire setting, burglary, theft, animal abuse, serious assault and school violence, and have engaged in attempted suicide behaviors as well. And they exhibit the poor social skills and peer relations, and some of these have major medical problems as well, be it diabetes or seizures. And many of these kids displaying their mentally and emotional problems, also incapredic, as well as enuretic. We at St. Mary's, we value the whole child, and we provide the necessary services that will remediate their own behavioral issues with medical services, psychiatric, mental health, education, counseling, and recreational and family services, emphasizing their transition back into the community. We are one of the agencies that provide services in the community, and I know that with your budget considerations, some of our agencies or beds will not exist. We are also able to assist these youngsters as they transition back, and when we do a six-month follow-up, we are still in the mid-70% percentile as being successful, and we feel we make a major attempt to follow up with these youngsters at 3, 6, 12, and 24 months. So programs in the community do make a difference and become a major asset to the state as we look and view these youngsters as they need all the help they can get. And we hope you will consider services in the community as well that are related to OYA's budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dennis.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee, my name is Gary Hansen. I'm the executive director of Bob Loney Ranch in Coos Bay, Oregon. We've been providing services to the community for over 30 years that range from crisis intervention through residential treatment, shelter care, and independent living. The original Boys Ranch was established at the impetus of the federal district court judge, Robert C. Baloney. The original ranch was built entirely of community-donated funds, labor, materials, and so forth. What we're about is we teach kids to be successful. At our on-campus school serving youth at the Boys Ranch and the Winneva Johnson Center for Girls, 75% to 85% of the students show improvement in their test scores and grade levels. At our shelter care program, 67% to 72% of the youth show improvement in their problem-solving and life skills ability. At the close of service, 85% to 95% of our youth investment clients have had no contact or further contact with the juvenile justice system. But our long-term partnership with the state of Oregon and with the Oregon Youth Authority is threatened by these budget cuts that have happened. The Oregon Youth Authority, in response to the downturn in revenue and the failure of ballot measure 28, canceled their shelter care contract. Unless we find alternative sources of funding, we're going to close our shelter care come June 30th. That means 180 to 240 kids will not have services in each of the coming years. We support a continuum of care. We believe ours has been a successful partnership with the state of Oregon, with the Oregon Youth Authority. Not too long ago, a young man visited a former Boys Ranch residence. And while we were reminiscing, he was commenting to me about the fact that he thought he got a pretty raw deal at Bologna Ranch because he had to stay there and make changes. It wasn't about do the crime, do the time. On the other hand, his brother and partner in crime was out of McLaren in 6 months. But then he commented, you know, I have a house, I'm married, I have a child, I have a good job, and I'm paying taxes. My brother is looking at a 10-year prison sentence. So he's consuming taxes. What we feel is that private nonprofits such as Bologna Ranch are a good deal for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Green?
Chairman Petridge and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arnie Green from Medford, Oregon. I'm the executive director of an agency called Community Works, and we've been providing residential treatment for delinquents for over 35 years in Southern Oregon. I would just like to make a couple of points and be additive and not repetitive, if I can. I was one of the few people who publicly, anyway, went out on a limb back when now Governor Kulongowski began the creation of the Oregon Youth Authority, opposed to that concept. And this is the second or third session that I'm here to apologize for that. I think that the Oregon Youth Authority is a great agency, very dynamic, very responsive, and the cuts that they've had to make in their own administrative staff, let alone the cuts in services, have I hope don't weaken them to a point where they can't continue to do the good work that they've been doing. My main point today, I think, is that the nonprofits are businesses. Some of you are business folks. The only difference between some of our agencies and a regular business is we don't pay corporate taxes, but we have health insurance issues, and we have OSHA and regulations and all the other stuff that all businesses have. And there will come a time when these cuts, if they occur on top of child welfare cuts, on top of Commission on Children and Family cuts, on top of delinquency and prevention cuts, and on, education cuts, will make some of us go out of business. And as Mr. Balter said, once these programs go out of business, it's going to take decades to bring them back, if then. I think I oversaw the creation of one of the last community programs that was cited in the mid-90s in Ashland, Oregon, not known to be a very conservative community, and I swore I would never try to cite another delinquent facility again, because it was nearly impossible to do. So as you're making these cuts, I hope you will give that some consideration. And a final point is, when we make a cut in an OIA bed, and I've already lost four beds in my program in the last round of cuts, I not only lost the OIA money, I lost mental health money that went with those kids, I lost alcohol and drug money that went with those kids, and I lost educational money that went with those kids. So four beds, to me, totaled over $200,000. So when I get a cut in a bed, there's a whole bunch of stuff that rolls into that as well. So thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Questions of the committee for the panel? We certainly appreciate the work that your nonprofits do. I think you've been able to be innovators and, as Representative Butler would say, get get more water to the end of the row. So we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And speaking of Representative Butler, his hometown is Alex Contreras and Mary Botkin are both here. And since Alex is from Ontario, I'm going to let you come up early, Mary.
You know, that's why I brought him up.
All right.
Should we begin?
Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alex Contreras, and I represent the Oregon Youth Authority as a parole and probation officer. I've been in this particular field for going on 13 years now. My career actually began with the Department of Corrections as a parole and probation officer there. However, it was pretty frustrating and extremely difficult to attempt to work with adult offenders based on the fact that you had just basically a revolving cycle in and out of the county jails. I particularly remember the incident that basically directed my career towards the juvenile system is that I had arrested a adult offender for severely beating his young son. And just like the movies and the books you read, by the time this individual was processed and released from the jail, he was already hitchhiking by the time I was headed back to my home office. So at that time, I took a glance over at the Oregon Youth Authority and taking a look at the direction that they were heading and the response that they were providing for our communities and the opportunities for reformation for our youth and then the method that they held their individuals accountable, I felt that that was obviously the place that I wanted to be at. One of the things that was very insightful for me was the fact that when an individual is placed into the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, there are several characteristics that basically push this youth into our direction. Number one is obviously it's in the best interest of the youth to be placed in our custody for substitute cares and the resources and the monies and wraparound services. The other one is the fact that that the individual has more than likely not completely exhausted all the local resources. Our courts try over and over again, as do our brother POs, the local juvenile probation officers. It's only a certain amount of time that you can continue and repeatedly put an individual in attempt to try to service them local county before you say, you know what, enough is enough. Also, these individuals, once they get to a point where they don't feel the sting of the court anymore, then that's when the move to Oregon Youth Authority occurs. When we began to take a look at these potential cuts, which was several months ago, that's when we started losing hope as parole and probation officers out in the communities. I mean, we are, in a sense, the trench workers and the individuals that try to guide these particular kids towards reformation. Now you look at reformation, and it takes a lot of services, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of heartache. When you begin to work with as a juvenile, you look down at the tunnel, you see either a road to success, or you see at the light at the end of the tunnel, or you see a light coming, but it being a train. Now, irregardless of what the situation is with our kids, we have to try to, as best as we possibly can, try to head them towards the road of reformation. We no longer are going to be having that ability. We have lost a heck of a lot of resources. We've lost opportunities to hold these youth accountable. The courts are in the same position we are. We take kids in front of the courts, and the courts will basically give them a citation for them to come back July 4th or maybe further down the line. These kids are basically, in a sense, just laughing at us. One of the things that we would appreciate is for this particular committee to take a look at is that it's been well documented from statements made by director from the community and such is that the bulk of the responsibility lies with the parole and probation officers. I mean, we are the starting point and we are the ending point. An incident that occurred is that we as Oregon Youth Authority developed a criteria in order to release our offenders back into the streets, the ones that, as we called it, our go and no-go list. The individuals that were on our go list were property crimes, individuals with a certain amount of police referrals, amount of runaways, and things of that nature. But these people are still going out and victimizing our community. An example was, I had a youth who was had been in the system since he was 7 years old. Got up to the Oregon Youth Authority and had been incarcerated for quite a while. However, he was a property crime offender. We were directed to release him. Took him less than 2 weeks to commit 5 felony crimes. He ran away from the foster home, stole a vehicle, got into a high speed chase, which obviously put the officer at risk and himself. Got caught in a apartment complex, wrecked a number of vehicles, ended up in the porch of a family. And this individual has been revoked. However, more than likely not, if we have the criteria to remain the same, he's probably going to be out on the streets in a little while. We have other individuals that are in the same boat where they have done nothing productive in our community, in our facilities. However, based on those particular characteristics, they're back on the street. We understand that we're not going to be revoking them based on technical violations. So this individual doesn't go to school, is not going to treatment, continues to smoke dope, to sit home. But there's really not much we can do. So those are the kind of things that we are being confronted with on our end. I've been looking at, I've been walking down these halls, I've been hearing about the proposed budgets and things of that nature, specifically surrounding the Department of Corrections, that they're not going to be taking cuts or, things of that nature. And I wonder why that's the way it is. Well, as I started reading all the information and hearing, all these testimonies take place, it was pretty crystal clear to me is that we, several months ago, released several hundred youth offenders. We're now in a position where we're potentially going to release several more hundred. Well, I think Governor Kunglowski has it. I mean, he understands it very clearly. These are the kind of kids that are headed to the Department of Correction. So, in a nutshell, just like I said, I just want you guys to be aware of the fact is that, positive growth does take change, but it's got to be guided by somebody, and the bulk of the responsibility lays on the parole and the probation officers. And if we are diminished or eliminated, then, like I said, our kids don't stand a chance, and we're getting really close to not only not providing the services as necessary and they're obligated to receive, but we're getting really close to providing a disservice to our kids.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of everybody else who's here, I will be very brief. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with AFSCME Council 75, and Alex misspoke. He's not here representing OIA.
I'm sorry.
He's here representing the... he's here representing AFSCME. He is not authorized to speak for the authority, the youth authority. So let me just be clear. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, having said that, mistakes happen. I want to say a couple of things. Number one, this is no longer an agency that handles kids who. This isn't the 50s anymore. They didn't steal a car. They hurt somebody and took their car. This is no longer kind of the 40s and the 50s, Bing Crosby and Mickey Rooney at Boys Town. This isn't what it's like anymore. These are very serious offenders. Part of it's probably because of the weapons of choice kids have today, the drugs of choice. Drugs have gotten much meaner. Weapons have gotten much less personal. And it is a population that nobody wants in their neighborhood. And so what we end up with is trying to figure out how you sort the list. And our members sort the list by who they can save. Alex used a term with me yesterday about...
reformation, turning towards termination.
Yeah, about, working towards termination. That's when you identify the kid as this kid can't be saved. And how do we just get rid of him and get him into the adult system? I have some suggestions, actually, for this budget. And, Mr. Chair, every member of this committee knows I want our 22 POs back because I think that's where it's at. That's what makes this happen is the field services and the oversight and the accountability that our POs provide. And we lost 22 of those folks, and we want them back. So here's what we suggest as a starting point. And we know this doesn't solve the whole problem. You got to get rid of those regional directors. Period. End of discussion. You can't direct a program that doesn't exist. Excuse me, but this is not an agency that was created to create jobs. It's an agency that was created to provide oversight and accountability for bad kids who are on their way to adult corrections. We got to reduce the administration. I thought it was very interesting. I love Karen Brazeau. I love these folks. But you know what? The administration budget increased while everything else decreased. Sorry, don't need them. I go into every budget that we have before us, and you know I am the public safety queen. I go into every budget and say, if you do not provide a direct service to a client, if you do not provide direct care, treatment, or security for our clients, I want to know why you exist. Because our job is to keep the community safe. That's it. Our job is not to feel good about each other or to sit around in meetings and talk about what ought to be. I have sat on the transition team for public safety for three governors. I've listened to everybody talk about what they want to do with public safety, and very little of it, except for the creation of OIA, come to fruition. I want to fix Representative Butler's problems. We're going to need beds in the Department of Corrections. We know that. Part of it's because we're going to inherit Alex's kids when they fail, and there's going to be more of them failing. Part of it's just because crime rates aren't going down, they're going up, and we need beds. So, you know, give us Burns and Oak Prineville. You know, we can put twice as many people in it. We don't need, you know, we don't have the same requirements that the youth authority has. And but don't just abandon those beds, because those are very important beds. And at some point, this economy will turn around. I actually agree with Steve Dole. He's absolutely right. Let's figure out a way to reopen Warrenton and Oak Creek. Give DOC authority to utilize the vacant facilities. Let us do what we need for the adult side, and hopefully in a couple of years the economy will improve and we can do what we need to do for youth authority, because we know that the most valuable resources our people in this agency have is an empty bed. Kids don't want to lose their weekends. They don't want to go back to a hard, close custody bed. And if we can make sure that they know that there's always an empty bed for them, for every child somewhere, that it's easier for them to keep the kids on the straight and narrow. And that really is what we're all about. And it's the only way we're going to slow down the growth at the adult end, is to put some resources back into the juvenile end. And, you know, I'll be in here next week talking about how we need to put more resources in adult. But you know what? I've said it from the very beginning, and Mr. Chair, I've never played games with you. I will advocate for every one of our budgets based on the merits of the budget and what we need. I'll not ask you for positions that aren't critical. I will ask you for the positions that we have to have, and I believe that your communities are going to need our parole officers to make sure that those kids, when they come out of the institution or come out from underneath close custody, somebody's holding them accountable and somebody's there that you can call when your constituents have a problem. And it's people like Alex that are going to be at the other end of the phone for you. It's not going to be me. And it's not me. Maybe it'll be Karen, but she'll end up calling Alex. You know? So, that's it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks.
Other questions for the panel? All right. Thank you. Pam Patton.
My name is Pam Patton, and I am president of the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls, which is a statewide nonprofit organization with a mission to ensure that the state's 1993 equal access law is implemented and to ensure that girls at risk get equal access to appropriate services. I had written testimony for you today, but my computer deleted it. No fault of my own, of course, but I will get a copy of it to you as soon as I can rewrite it. So I'm talking from some scratch notes, but I will try and make this quick. I'm here today to talk about our concerns regarding the disproportionate impact of the latest cuts to OIA and also the proposed cuts to OIA will have on the services to girls and young women. It might be assumed that since girls are 11%, only 11% of the youth in closed custody, that there would be more of an impact on boys than the effect it would have on girls. If you believe that, that is actually inaccurate. The reality is that these cuts will severely decrease the number of girls who get access to OIA services, both at the community level and in closed custody. What has already started to happen with the cuts that happened from the failure of ballot measure 28 is that we are losing the number of girls who are coming into OIA. What happens is what I call the domino theory, that when the Oregon Youth Authority has to determine which youth will get service, they are required to serve the highest offender. And when the highest offender is served, that's usually not your female. Oregon and the coalition did a study to look at 10 years of violent behavior by females in OIA and found that there was 129% increase in violence by females from 1987 through 96. That doesn't mean that females are committing violent crimes the same way boys are, and so they're ending up actually not necessarily, unless they're ballot measure 11, being considered the high-risk offenders in OIA. So what will happen is that the youth that OIA can no longer serve, because we've sent them back to the counties, will need to be served by the juvenile departments. The juvenile departments have worked as OIA has worked over the last 10 years to increase prevention services for juveniles that are females. We are seeing with all these cuts that we are decreasing the services to females at the community level and in the prevention services. So OIA is going to see the highest level offenders. Those offenders that can't be seen by OIA will go back to the county juvenile departments. They will need to serve those youth, and the majority will be boys. We'll see the girls not being served by OIA because they won't be referred, not being served by the juvenile departments, and the community juvenile crime prevention programs that were started for girls will be gone because they will be serving the boys. So we're going to see a 10-year loss in what I call the domino theory of decreased access for girls. When we look at these girls, I think we need to know a little bit about them. And first I want to talk about what OIA has done the last 6 years in order to increase their best practices services to girls. The coalition is committed to getting gender-specific and research-based services to the girls in the custody of the state or in provided services through the state, because we believe that if you don't give them effective treatment, they won't have the outcomes that we want for the young women. OIA has been working towards that. One of the things that has occurred is that they established the Corvallis House, which is a transition program for girls coming out of Hillcrest. That transition program is based on best practices for young women, and also is the only transition program in OIA for females. All the others are for the males. They also have returned all the young women to Hillcrest so that they could serve the young women in a more comprehensive and effective gender-specific manner if they were in one facility as opposed to very sparsely spread out through all the regional facilities. The other thing is that they've looked at after, if you remember 4 years ago, there were 4 suicides at Hillcrest. 3 of them were young women. That encouraged the legislature to increase the funding for mental health, alcohol and drug, and nurse practitioner staff at Hillcrest. That has had a positive impact on services to young women and the young men that are at Hillcrest. And if we look at some of the young women at Hillcrest, what you would may like to know about them is that approximately 81% of these females met a psychiatric clinical diagnosis, that they have most of them have had multiple suicide attempts. In Oregon, not for just OYA girls, but for girls in general, 76% of suicide attempts of youth are by females. We also know that 75% of the young women acknowledge sexual abuse, and that is probably an underestimate because not some young women aren't able to talk about that. Over 57% of the females in close custody had co-occurring substance abuse and mental health disorders. And one of the things that came out as evidence for gender-specific services for females came out in a study by the National Center on Addictions and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. They did a 3-year study looking at boys and girls and what kinds of reasons they use and abuse alcohol, drug, tobacco, and other drugs. And what they found was is that we have not been providing gender-specific services for girls. We've been providing gender-neutral or male-based services, which is what we talk about when we advocate for gender-specific services for girls. And that because of that, this national study has said that the women of America have paid a fearful price for the failure of us to provide gender-specific services for girls. So what I'm hoping that you will look at when you're considering cuts is the impact that we'll have on girls who have a right to be able to receive the services that they're supposed to receive and that they should be gender specific, and that we don't create a system by virtue of the money that does not allow them to get access into the system. And ultimately what it does, it sends them back to the community for no services. And so even though we have seen in Oregon decreases in teen pregnancy, decreases in alcohol and drug use, and some decreases in suicide attempts, we will see those all go up again if we don't take care of our young women at every point in the continuum. So they need their community-based services as well as they need their services at OYA. So we believe that that's good public policy and good use of your funds to take care of our young women, and we hope you will consider that when you make your decisions.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Pat?
Thank you very much. I have people on the list besides the Juvenile Directors Association people. Are there other people who are here who came from over 100 miles? Okay, then what I'm going to do at this point in time is part of the juvenile directors have, so I'm going to bring them up first. I tried to do that on the list, but some people marked the wrong boxes, and I won't say whom, but you know who you are. So if the Juvenile Directors Association can come forward, Lisa Smith, Tim Lowen, Matthew Burns, and Larry Oglesby. And is Tammy Bodine with me as well? Or?
No.
No, okay.
Representative Patridge and members of the committee, I don't know if you have this handout in front of you. I've already scribbled on mine, but it's one listed the juvenile justice system. My name is Tim Lowen. I'm the juvenile department director from Yamhill County, and we're going to all present here today, and I'll have everybody introduce themselves. Oregon's juvenile justice system, a collaboration of state, county, municipal, public safety, social service, educational agencies, and I might add, after hearing some of the other testimonies I left out, both public and private providers and agencies, resources have developed into one of the best reformative and preventative systems in the nation. I draw your attention to, on the back of this form, has what are benchmarks set up by the Progress Board for the juvenile justice system. Oregon's crime prevention strategy of intervening early in the life of the juvenile offender has paid off in the reduction of crime. And what you'll see on these is that we're measured in our system by juvenile arrests in person crimes, juvenile arrests in property crimes, and recidivism. Recidivism really measures those youth who have been referred to the system already, and we're trying to prevent those youth from committing new crimes. In each of these areas, we've had dramatic impacts in reducing crime to the level that it's actually below those projected for 2005. Juvenile crime in Oregon peaked in 95, the same year that the legislature passed Senate Bill 1 that created the Oregon Youth Authority. By expanding the continuum of resources and services aimed at reducing juvenile crime, we have seen crime rates drop 8% below the 2005 Oregon benchmark. Subsequently, we've seen these youth offenders become adults, and the overall rate has dropped from the 1997 high to within 2.5% of the 2005 Oregon benchmark for crime. In fact, in one large Oregon county, juvenile arrests have dropped from 40.3 arrests per 1,000 in 96 to 23.4 arrests per 1,000. Clearly, the tremendous drop in the first-time arrests and rearrests can be largely attributed to the partnerships with Oregon Youth Authority and the development of locally planned, proven programs for juvenile offenders. One of the things I want to comment on was or make reference to was a comment to OIA's administration and lack of cuts in budgets. Part of that administrative cost goes to supporting an infrastructure of what we have is our information system, juvenile justice information system. This is a model program, actually, not just for our state, but I think for the nation. There are very few states that have a similar type database. That impacts everyone really associated with the information system. And I wanted to say that that's a collaboration that has gone on since 95 and when OIA was created. The state is now faced with unprecedented financial problem of having to prioritize and cut services throughout all state funded agencies. Public safety agencies, and more specifically those departments with no constitutional or statutory mandated services, such as OIA and OSP, are likely to see a disproportionate share of these cuts. An unfortunate result is that counties are obligated to address the public safety need in spite of the state's reduction. With the state reducing its resources for juvenile offenders, the youth will remain in the community with inadequate supervision and programs to meet their needs. At the same time, county funding is dramatically reduced. In 1985, the state reduced the juvenile justice closed custody population from 775 to 513 beds. Diversion grants were awarded to those county juvenile departments agreeing to reduce the number of youth offenders committed to the state institutions. These diversion grants enabled juvenile departments to create resources to intervene locally in the lives of some very dangerous youth offenders. The Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association would ask that you prioritize programs and services that maintain diversion and juvenile crime prevention grants to counties. That you maintain the Oregon Youth Authority as the primary state agency for addressing juvenile justice needs for Oregon's youth. Maintain secure closed custody resources for our most dangerous youthful offenders, and maintain resources that serve the most youth for the least amount of funding. We believe that through the continued collaborative efforts of state and local planning, that we can continue the best efforts toward public safety in these very trying financial times.
Chair Patridge, members of the committee. My name is Matthew Burney. I'm the Juvenile Department Director from Jefferson County. I'm here representing OJDDA as well as the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium. Speaking from small county perspective, especially that east of the Cascades, in these communities, 17 counties in our consortium, 16 of which pool most of our resources from the state, we have most of the poorest counties in the state, the most ethnically diverse counties in the state, and some of the highest juvenile crime rates in the state. But because of our small populations, the individual grants we get from the state are usually not enough to be effective. So what COJAC, or the Central and Eastern Oregon Justice Consortium, has done is leverage those state funds by pooling them to create programs that there's no way that small rural communities can create independently. And those efforts, along with the basic services and prevention grants, have made some really remarkable strides. By being creative with that money, we've created programs that have had a tremendous effect in Jefferson County, in particular. In the late 90s, we had as high as 94 juvenile arrests per 1,000, which, as you can see by quoting some of the numbers from the bigger counties, is a very severe local problem. And in the last year for which there were statistics, we had dropped to 51.4, which is still above the state average, but is a tremendous reduction. That reduction was achieved primarily through the cooperative and collaborative efforts and programs we've been able to put together through COJAC. So I would just urge that as you look at the cuts that you are going to make and have to make, that you recognize that, especially in small rural communities, that those state monies are essential. Because of the poverty of many of these areas, there will not be any ability to do any kind of backfilling. And those counties will, and their judges will probably be sending more kids to state care, at the same time that we've already experienced, as you know, significant cuts in the beds and the facilities available to us. But if the local system breaks down, there will be really no other alternative, which leads to a really dysfunctional system and a return to the crime rates that we've successfully addressed. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Lisa Smith, and I'm director of the Lane County Department of Youth Services. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about Lane County's usage of the basic and the diversion funds. Currently, those funds are utilized to pay for the sex offender treatment team and for the male shelter in Lane County. Both of those programs serve the highest risk youth in our community. With the OYA cuts, and their cuts of their shelter contracts, if there are cuts to the diversion and the basic service funds, that will effectively eliminate shelter for high-risk delinquent youth in Lane County. The cuts to basic and diversion funds would present the juvenile justice agencies with a real crisis of credibility, for lack of a better term, where we will, in essence, be sitting across from a youth going, don't do that. If you ever do that again, I'm going to have you come back in here and tell you, don't ever do that again, because, quite frankly, there won't be resources to do anything else but that. Our closed custody cap has been reduced by one-third. These kids are still committing the crimes. They're still in our communities. The basic and diversion funds have allowed us to have the resources to try to work with those kids in the community and try to create the resources that fit our community, and that's the flexibility has been really critical to the success of those programs. So that I would ask that you all keep that in mind in making these decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I listened to testimony here this afternoon, it's kind of a trip down memory lane for me. I came in and the system...
You need to identify yourself.
Oh, excuse me, Chair. My name is Larry Oglesby. I'm director of the Marion County Juvenile Department. I entered the juvenile system in 1986, right after the legislature downsized the state institutions and created the diversion program. I heard testimony about the 1994 summit and the task forces that came out of that and was part of that process. And then I was also part of the task force the work group that developed the juvenile crime prevention strategy. Ironically, over those 16 years, we took a system that was down and out and really built it to the place where it was a system we can be proud of. And unfortunately, within the last year and a half, we're seeing that start to erode. So I guess what I'm here to say today is we want to work with the legislature, recognizing you have cuts to make, to do this in the most professional and strategic manner possible so that we preserve as much as possible this system and maintain it as a system that can serve youth offenders and serve our communities. At our your hearing last week on juvenile crime prevention, I appeared with Joe Christie from Washington County and Doug Poppin, the juvenile director in Clackamas County, and Mr. Chair, you asked us to respond on some specific questions. So the written testimony I've submitted is a letter which does that, and I'd just like to cover that briefly. The question you asked was, what would be the impact of the reduction or elimination, actually, of juvenile crime prevention funds, juvenile crime basic funds, and the diversion funds? Our legislative committee met yesterday and talked about this at some length, and I have highlighted those things, and I just could put them on the record in terms of what we see the impacts being, beginning with a significantly diminished community safety for our local communities, more victims and a reduced capacity to address those victims' needs, a lack of accountability for juvenile offenders, as Ms. Smith just described, sending the message to youth that community norms do not have to be respected. Only the most serious crimes would be handled, with little or no response for most of the other youth who were referred to us. A revolving door just juvenile system that has offenders remaining in the community even after all local efforts have been exhausted, and that the ones who are committed to the Oregon Youth Authority returning sooner only to be revoked and then paroled again, and so on as that revolving door continues to spin. Youth offenders remaining in or returning to local communities will include sex offenders, youth who have committed other serious person-to-person crimes and serious property crimes, and more youth will move on to the adult system and be a burden on the state in terms of long-term Department of Corrections services. You've heard testimony about the diversion program. It was put in place in order to for the community to be able to respond to the youth who were moved out of state care when those two cottages were closed at Hillcrest and McLaren back in 1985. The discretionary beds that we have at this point in time are actually lower than that level we were in 1985, despite the fact that the youth population in Oregon has grown between 30% and 40% since that time. In addition, some of the other resources that we have relied upon from OIA, shelter care, residential treatment. Residential treatment has been significantly reduced. You heard from the providers here this afternoon. Shelter care no longer exists in the Oregon Youth Authority. That's gone completely. The only shelter available now is at the local level, provided by local counties and private nonprofits. So our response in terms of how we would propose to address these challenges, three basic principles that we have identified. One is to maintain a balanced system, one that has a continuum of sanctions and services that would be most effective in addressing the needs of whichever youth we're able to address. And the reality, as you've heard before, is a lot of these youth we're going to do nothing with, send a letter to the parents, refer them to community programs, that sort of thing. But whatever number of youth we're able to serve, having a continuum of services so that we can serve them effectively is really important. Secondly, a flexibility in our ability to meld available resources that we provide at the local level along with those provided by the state so that we can focus on the higher risk youth and at the same time try to do what we can to continue to invest in prevention as we have been doing this last couple of years. And then thirdly, to combine, we recommend that you look at combining funding streams. We have the three that are on the budget here that we're talking about now, in order to continue and refine our focus on the evidence-based strategies that we've been working on for some time and continue to measure our effectiveness. We believe that it's our responsibility to run good programs and make sure we're running good programs and do that by measuring them and so that we're being wise stewards of the public's money. So finally, I would just mentioned that in terms of specific priorities, clearly we believe that further cuts in OIA beds is the highest priority. Not cutting for those beds would be the highest priority. Secondly, we believe focusing on the integrity of the local system, the basic services and the diversion monies, which are woven in with local funds, are critical in terms of keeping those in place. And to the extent that we have the flexibility to do that and the funds to do that, whatever the final outcome is, to continue to focus on prevention to the extent we have the capacity to do that.
All right. Questions from members of the committee?
Thank you,
Matt. Thank you.
I have Gary Westaby, Elroy Sampson, and Marshall Bixel from SEIU. Are there other SEIU people who were here who were supposed to testify today? Might as well take you all as a group.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Sir.
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Marshall Bixel. I work at McLaren School. Have been there since 1977. Have had some real different experiences. I do not represent OYA. I represent myself. When I started at McLaren School in 1977, most of the young men there were there for truancy, runaway, being incorrigible in the home, shoplifting, and things of that nature. Very few assaultive behavior people. We had a small unit at the time, which was D1 at the time, was for those assaulted people, or D2, I'm sorry. Today, the representation of those young people has changed considerably. Rape, murder, drive-by shootings, burglaries, assaulted behavior of all kinds, drugs, alcohol, weapons charges from one end to the other. I work in an outdoor program which takes young men, and we go out in a community to do volunteer work for the U.S. Forest Service, the Department of Bureau of Land Management, and the Fish and Game Department throughout the whole state of Oregon. We spend usually 1 week at a time living in a large tent out in the woods. We build bridges, shelters, trails. Do fishing platforms. We build fence for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Lands Management, miles and miles of fence of all varieties. It teaches these young men good work skills, so they, when they are ready to be transitioned back into the community, they do know what it is to work a full day's work. They also know what it is to take some pride in what they have accomplished when they can look back and see these projects have been done in a superior fashion. We take great pride in our young men when we turn them back into the community. I can tell you from my own experience, many Christmases, many Father's Days, getting postcards, phone calls from these young men over the years, that has made my investment in those young men well worthwhile. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drexel.
Hi, my name is Jim Shelley. McLaren. I, too, don't represent the institution. I'm speaking on my own behalf. I have some statistics I was going to give you all, but after listening to Mr. Dahl's testimony, it kind of brought back a memory of back in 1993. I was assigned to a young man that had taken one Miss Lisa Marie Dahl's life, and at that time I thought that was probably the low point of the agency. This was before OIA was established. We were still CSD. Watching that young man walk out of the door was very disheartening, and it took a lot out of us, and I'm sure Mr. Dole's family. Some good came out of it, I think, about Measure 11, OIA, all that was implemented. I would hate for us to forget why that came to light, why these changes were made. There's some dangerous kids out there, and they are doing some pretty dangerous crimes, and you know, we all know that history repeats itself, so I would hate to see, you know, these cuts take the teeth out of OIA, because it's a very valuable service that we offer. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Celery Sampson. I work at McLaren. I've been there for quite a while, and two, I'm just here to give you some information on how things pretty much operate with the cuts that's in the foreseeable future. I had some stuff written out I was going to bring and do some other things, but I decided, no, I just cut to the chase and let you know what's happening. is that when you we had Measure 28 come through and it failed and what have you, quite a bit of the youth out there, they were getting ready to have not a party, but they were kind of celebrating with inside because they knew they were getting out. And treatment was out the window. They were getting out. So we were in a scramble to see who was the least likely to offend, what type of offense they were going to do, how, what type of crime to let these people out. So as we were going through those processes and letting them out, what we figured out that we as staff out there knew was going to happen is that quite a few were going to reoffend. We had one young man got out at 10. He was reoffended at 3 o'clock. A warrant was out for his arrest the same day he got out for doing his drug on the street. And amongst other things, we had another young man who had gotten out 2 weeks. He had assaulted his father, kind of. He was back in trouble. Well, it goes on and on. And what we were doing is that we as staff were saying, this young man should not be going. He should not be ready because treatment was there, but when the cuts came, treatment had to be put aside because we had to get the beds out. And doing so, we did a disservice to the people, that the judges and the citizens who they had reoffended, who sent them there because we didn't get complete treatment. We did a disservice to the young men by putting them back out on the street without complete treatment. And then we also did a disservice to the victims who are out there right now being victimized. So when we come up here and we sit and we talk about all these things, we come back, you're looking at some more cuts, is that we're going to repeat this process over and again and over again. Somewhere it has to stop, because when judge sends a young man to McLaren or to Hillcrest or whatever for treatment and he doesn't get that treatment, then somewhere we have failed the system, we failed the judge, we failed the victim, and we failed the person that we're supposed to be treating because of budget cuts. I don't envy you. I don't envy the legislature trying to find the money, because I know it's very difficult. This is a real bad time we're in. But when you have people who need treatment, who need to be in treatment, who need to go through the programs, who need to get rid of the violent behavior, well, true enough, we're not going to save them all. But the ones that we can do something with, we should give them, have the opportunity to do it. And you got a lot of dedicated people in this state right now who's looking towards that. And we're looking out for safety of the public and for your safety, too. Everybody's safety right here, because they got to have some treatment. If you don't treat a person food, bad thoughts and bad things, then we actually give them the green light to go ahead and recommit. So we really appreciate your help in this, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Patridge, members of the committee, my name is Gary Westby for the record. I'm the president of Service International. Service Employees International Union, representing the workers of Oregon Youth Authority. I also work for the Oregon Youth Authority, but I'm not speaking here on behalf of the agency. I'm speaking on behalf of the membership. Thank you for your time. I very much appreciate the opportunity to speak here today about this very important issue and House Bill 5058. I have a handout that I put over on the table, but I don't know if it got to you yet. They asked.
It'll get to us.
Okay, great. Thank you. I want to just kind of summarize a little bit about what's happened. I don't want to beat the same drum, because you've heard a lot of testimony this afternoon, and I've also sat in as the agency provided testimony over the last 2 days. I do want to bring forward a couple of key points, and that is that the Oregon Youth Authority does provide a continuum of service from the beginning of a youth's wayward travels and probation all the way through incarceration, if it goes that down that road, on to post-incarceration or commitment, into foster care, residential treatment programs, and even post-close custody supervision. That continuum of service is integral in the successful treatment of these youth as they continue down that road. And it's essential that we maintain the whole continuum of service and don't try to cut one area versus the other. I was encouraged, Chair Patridge, when you said that you weren't really starting with the governor's budget. You're just hearing testimony, and that's really an encouraging note for me, because I believe that there's some services that we've significantly been reduced that are vital to the public safety of the Oregonians here. You also heard testimony yesterday that recidivism. Youth through the Oregon Youth Authority, the recidivism rate is about 26%, but the youth that were recently released as a result of House Bill 5100, those youth have reoffended or created other violations to the tune of around 40%. Keep in mind, I'd like for the community to keep in mind that these were the least likely to, or the least risk to the communities. That's the youth that were released as a result of House Bill 5100. Anybody else that we release are more risky to the communities. And with those kind of statistics, it's very scary for us to go down that road. I also want to talk a little bit about intervention versus incarceration. And we all know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I have some statistical data here from a couple of different websites of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I might also say that a great vast majority of the youth that we serve are have chemical dependency problems and fall into this category as well. One of the quotes here is, studies have shown, this is a nationally renowned study, studies have shown that $4 to $7 are saved for every dollar spent on treatment. And if we close the door on youth authority or youth authority services, we are essentially signing that we're willing to spend more later than we're willing to spend now. And I want to make sure that that's very clear for the record. So it's important that early intervention is paramount with the success of these youth. After all, we're building our future with these youth. We're investing in our future. The other piece that I want to summarize with is the economic impact of any additional closures to correctional facilities. We've already severely handicapped Clatsop County, Lynn and Benton counties with the closures of Warrenton North Coast Youth Correctional Facility, Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility, and Crook County and Harney County from Eastern Oregon Youth Correctional Facility and the Ochoco Youth Correctional Facility. Those economic hardships are hard to fully realize. I would hate to see any additional cuts to the agency. And in fact, I would even suggest that there's been some great suggestions here at the table this afternoon in the testimony from Mr. Dole and Ms. Botkin about alternatives to actually restoring some of the agency. I would like for the committee to keep in mind that these are essential public services that need to be maintained, and all Oregonians are counting on us to make the right decisions. And I guess I would just summarize, close with that. So if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I think the only question I have, and I asked yesterday, I think, and got some response back, but you guys are obviously the ones who are delivering the service on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I just remain concerned with the fact that we have closed some of the other institutions and the criminality of the, for lack of a better word, of the individuals who are in custody currently.
Mm-hmm.
is much higher.
Higher
degree of criminality. I'm just concerned from your perspectives on the ground, whether the staffing is adequate to be able to protect your the employees of the Oregon Youth Authority as well.
I would like to say that I work at Camp Tillamook over in Tillamook, and I work adjacent to the TIAC, Tillamook Youth Accountability Camp, referred to as TIAC. And the paradigm of youth that come to those facilities now as a result of the passage of House Bill 5100 and the cuts that were imposed are significantly changed over what we provided before. What was driving the youth program changes and movements was their progression in treatment. And the progression of treatment was the incentive to keep the kids moving in the right direction. Now that has changed significantly, and now it's almost like we're scrambling to get kids through the program. The youth that we see now are have more, using your term, Chair Partridge, more criminality because we've released many of the least risky to the communities. So the youth that we have now are more serious offenders, I guess is the best way to say it. And I believe that the agency is going to give you some detail on that post presentation today, which was supposed to happen at the beginning of this afternoon's testimony. But I don't know all of those numbers, and it's been very difficult. Keep in mind we have a 5-week window by which to capture this from when we first started releasing youth until now. So it's a very narrow snapshot of time to be able to compile that kind of data. But we, in just that short 5-week period, we're already seeing repercussions as a result of it. And that should tell a significant story by itself.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
And listen to your question. It was kind of like in school.
For the record, this is Mr. Sampson.
Sampson, L.A. Sampson, for the record. Yeah, it's kind of like in the school. When you add more students and you keep the same amount of teachers or what have you, well, here at McLaren and Hillcrest within the system, when you sent a lot of youth out on the street, but we also absorbed a lot of youth from closing the facilities. So when your ratio went from 25 to 1, now it's at 27 to 1 to 28 to 1 to 30 to 1. Well, in your programs, when you do that, is that you devote a lot of time. So as a teacher, you split your time out. To each student doesn't have as much valuable time. So as you do your programs, it cuts back on your programs. As your population goes up, then that cuts down on the amount of time you can spend. It's just like in a regular school. And ours is a little bit more different because we're trying to change behavior from violent to nonviolent and be productive. And when you get into that mode, well, then you lose something. And that's what we're facing right now. With the cuts that's coming, we're facing that. And we'll face that again unless something is done. And the situation won't get any better, it will get worse. And then you'll have the staff morale, you'll have youth morale, you'll have administrators morale, you'll have all of us fighting and dealing with this, not physically, but dealing with these cuts. And we're all going to be blaming the legislature and the people of the state of Oregon for what they did to us, and the kids are back out on the street. It's a vicious circle. And we here today, and you as the legislature, have an opportunity to address the problem. I don't know how, again, I don't envy what you have to do, but it is something that needs to be done and to prevent this from getting any worse than what it is. Because once it does, there won't be an excuse. I don't think general public is going to buy any kind of excuse.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize to the committee for having had to be in the Senate committee on another bill, but I just, and this may have been covered in some of the other testimonies, you're going to have to give these youngsters an A for intelligence as to when something is going on, some external factors are going on outside of the institution. And certainly with our budget crisis and the crunch that we're experiencing, I just wonder if you've, in your experiencing and in your associations on the inside, is the word out that, hey, there isn't a hard bed that may back you up?
Jim Shelley, by the record, I'll speak. I'm unit coordinator on Grover Cottage and I also help divert parole violators back into the community or also into other resources within OIA. I guess my job is to contact the POs and get their recommendation on where they would like this youth going that they just revoked. And I listen to it, and I listen to it, and then I have to in turn tell them, well, we're going to divert this kid to a 45-day program in TIAC, and they'll tell me, yeah, he has pending charges, this, that, and the other. And I have to explain to them our hands are tied. We only have so many facility beds, and so we're potentially sending kids out that have very serious crimes into community programs where they in OIA programs that probably should never be there. And if it presents a public safety risk, if we continue this pattern, something's bound to happen. So far, we've gotten away, but I mean, we're running out of resources and beds to put these kids. And I know the word is out. It's the youth on our unit. It's not where am I on, you know, as far as, you know, group and everything else. It's where am I on the cap list? When am I leaving? They're not really buying into the treatment aspect that we're giving them. It's more, I know I'm getting out because they know there's a cap list. They know, you know, basically where they are because every county's given a cap and, you know, they kind of know by their crime where they're at on that cap list. So really, they're not buying into the treatment modalities we're giving them there.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically that attitude, I'm going to say if there's one thing it ain't, if there's one thing they ain't dumb. So is that attitude then infectious? If it passes from the good kids or from the tougher nuts to crack, is it moving on to the youngsters that were really making some progress before, and are we moving backwards in some instances?
Well, sir, Samson, for the record,
dealing with what they know is that on Measure 28, they knew who sponsored the bill, they knew when it's coming, they knew when the vote was, they knew what the vote was that night, they got the paper the next day, they knew what happened, and they had plans the following day who was getting out. This is the youth, not the staff, this is the youth. Now, with the budget cut that's projected right now, they already know that it's 18% to 40%. They're looking at what the governor already said. They don't know what you guys are doing here, but they know what the governor said, they know what it is, and they're already planning on who's going to be kept out. This is system-wide. This is not just in one cottage. This is system-wide. They're into the thing. They know that their taxpayers are revolting on taxation right now. They know that, and they know they can commit the crimes. They know they can get out. And I don't care what part of the state you come from, they know this already. So we're not hiding anything.
Well, tell them to keep guessing, because you don't know what the legislature is
going to do. Actually, they'll be able to testify tomorrow.
I have another question for you, too, and there's been a lot of talk in the committee about the caps and resources and diversionary beds and how whether those should be based on acuity or based on population as they currently are. How difficult does it make your job to manage based upon the caps that are in on the discretionary beds from county to county in terms of the programs that you're involved with?
Well, I can speak to Mr. Shelley again. I can speak a little bit on some of the DOC kids that we have that are, you know, mandatory sentence, and they see some youth that are going home after displaying, you know, paroled kids that were in fights the day before because of the cap reasons, and that kind of is demoralizing for them to see that they've done all this progress and treatment, and they've worked so hard to get where they're at, and they have a juvenile come in the system, and 5 days, 10 days, whatever, hasn't done anything, and they're being paroled to the community. So it kind of takes the teeth out of our program in that way, because we do rely on the adult offenders to kind of provide some leadership and show them, well, if you do good, this is what happens. And having that piece taken away from us, that really affects the overall morale and the way the institutions run.
So I'd like to add a little bit to that as well, and also the previous question. This is Gary Westaby, sorry for the record. The youth also have visitors that come and visit them, you know, their parents, family support network and whatnot, and they even know and actually contribute somewhat to keeping the kids informed about where certain legislation is and hoping that they could come home after a certain period of time. So, I mean, you can't keep them in a closet. And part of what we try to do is, and instead of institutionalizing the kids, we try to provide them with more normalization. We provide them with access to the newspaper, to the media, and so on and so forth, because we want them to be productive members of the community when they get out. As far as the caps go, it is very handicapping and demoralizing for the program when you have a youth that is not doing well, and as a result of county caps and discretionary beds, that particular youth, his number is up for all practical purposes, and you have to release him out into the community because of the cap program. And you know that the person right next to him, who may be a public safety reserve youth, or maybe his number just isn't up and he's a capped kid but not ready to be released. Maybe he's doing better with his treatment, but because of the way that the decisions are made, it seems to me like what regularly happens is, because of the cap system and the way that the counties run the caps, the sometimes the youth that you would want to see have the most treatment or be retained ends up getting the release. And so it's out of the hands of the workers, the frontline workers, from that perspective. And that goes back to the counties and the higher-ups in the agency. But we don't have any control over that. When they reach their cap, they have to release some youth. And that's what it boils down to. That's your experience.
Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there any opportunity, or are you ever called to serve on parole boards, frontline workers?
Jim, I'll let you speak to that.
No, we're not able to. I mean, we have our certain degree of input, but unfortunately it's the county's issue as far as their cap space, so we don't have any real input on what kids go or which kids don't. They have their own rating system on how they address that, and that's kind of out of our hands.
So the parole board issue is a local issue, not a state. It's not state overseen.
Yeah, I
think that there's different types of beds, and what and kind of the thrust of what I was trying to get to was the caps and the discretionary beds, and some counties are sending less youth with a lot less criminality per se than other counties, and so the thrust of my question was: does it affect the efficacy of your treatment programs within the realm of the institution? Because, and I think the answer is yes, from the ground level.
Mr. Chair, back when I was a kid in Madera County, it was 60 days for an overdue library book. I think Alex will tell you it's down.
How much
down
time
to
did you serve,
30
Mr.
days.
Mr. Representative Butler.
I didn't ever check out library.
Oh, okay. That's why you were an accountant.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, Gary Westby again for the record. I think that those are some real questions that we can maybe defer to Bob and Karen. I think that's part of what they're going to be presenting this afternoon. And Representative Butler, I would encourage you to ask those questions. I think they can give us some more detailed information on the actual how the cap system works. I'm not that well-tuned in that particular aspect of the decisions of the agency. So I'm maybe not the best source for that.
The chairman wanted to know from the ground level, because I can hear from the juvenile directors who have particular biases. I can hear from the agency who has a constituency that they have to be careful of. And I can get the straight scoop from you guys on
that.
I miss a lot more because you're not employed by a county, and there's some insulation between you and them.
Correct. I would say
Representative Hansen had a question.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, on a very simple... very similar vein, and this is probably more policy than budget, but as I understand the way the one aspect of the cap system is, if you're at the cap, somebody coming in pushes somebody out.
Right. That's correct.
Exactly.
Do you know if there's ever been consultation with line staff at McLaren or Hillcrest in terms of how the kid's doing that's being pushed out in relationship to the sentencing or the stuff affecting the kid coming in?
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I would say that the line staff normally, we have what they call primary assignments. Each line staff is assigned a certain number of youth on the living unit. That primary staff rates the progress of the youth weekly. And then that goes in through the unit coordinator, which is Jim here. And then through that unit coordinator and the treatment manager, they make some decisions on how the progress of the youth are. That's done through a it used to be a monthly case review, which is now a quarterly case review, which is used what they call a multidisciplinary task team of a group of people that get together from all aspects of the youth treatment program to make sure that their treatment plan and the reformation is being met. That would be all aspects, including treatment providers, mental health, physical health, treatment manager for the unit, program director, county, the parole and probation officer, any county directors. That's the multidisciplinary team where those decisions are made. The frontline staff don't normally get involved in that quarterly review process, but they do have input through the unit coordinator and through the treatment manager to provide the necessary input to make determinations on the outcome of the youth and how they're progressing. Does that help answer that question for you? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank all four of you.
Thank you.
Certainly appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, sir.
Jim Seymour is here. I have three people left to testify. So Jim Seymour, Cammie Bodine, and Deanne Beatrice. All three of you want to come up, and I'll go ahead and start with Mr. Seymour.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour, and I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services in Salem, Oregon. I hold a bachelor's degree with a major in corrections and a master's degree in public administration. Catholic Community Services is an accredited private, not-for-profit organization that has provided effective community programs for thousands of delinquent and emotionally disturbed youth since 1967. During the 1960s, there was a big debate at the Oregon legislature about whether to build a third juvenile training school or to invest in community programs. The legislature made the decision to invest in community programs by establishing and funding youth care centers. This decision was based in large part on evidence from Douglas County, where they experienced a dramatic drop in training school commitments after opening a community program known as Pitchford Boys Ranch. The youth care center movement in Oregon has been highly successful. Virtually every county that opened a youth care center experienced significant reduction in training school commitment rates. Youth care centers effectively prevented construction of additional juvenile closed custody bed space in Oregon for more than 20 years. These programs continue to play a vital role in the continuum of services for delinquent youth and their families. Today, fully one-third of the youth in OIA's custody are placed in community programs. Community programs produce positive outcomes in the areas of public safety, positive youth development, family functioning, and engaged communities. While no program, including a closed custody program, can completely eliminate risk to public safety, community programs successfully manage these risks. We work closely with parole and probation staff to identify the public safety risks presented by each youth we serve. We then develop and implement plans to manage these risks. Positive youth development and family functioning outcomes are achieved by engaging youth and their family members in a process to identify their goals, strengths, and needs. Youth and family members then receive the structure and support they need to succeed. When youth are served in the community stays engaged. With the right kind of structure, delinquent youth benefit from professional services and voluntary supports that already exist in the community. The Washington State Institute for Public Policy, in a May 2001 report, quantified the impressive taxpayer and crime victim benefits of community programming. And I've got an attachment there that sort of demonstrates that. Community programs in Oregon have done a good job in the past and can do an even better job in the future. I had the opportunity to meet with Karen Brazil last year before we realized how significant Oregon's financial problems really are. We talked about ideas that we believed could create breakthroughs in the quality and cost-effectiveness of community services. She encouraged me to work with others to develop a proposal and to come back. Three nonprofit organizations formed a limited liability company we call the Child, Youth, and Family Integrated Services Network. We have gone beyond collaboration to real partnership. Collectively, we have developed and submitted a proposal to Karen with the following guarantees. Cost reductions. We will reduce the cost of services by at least 15%. Public safety will be maintained or improved. Positive outcomes related to reduction in juvenile crime, improved family functioning, bonding with pro-social peers, work, and academic achievement. We will accept a no-decline contract that no Level 4 youth will be declined, and that our services will be unconditional in the sense that we will not punitively discharge any youth for service, only be for public safety reasons. Now more than ever, Oregonians expect quality, cost-effective services from government. I believe these expectations have been met through OIA's contracts with private non-for-profit organizations. Nevertheless, we can and must do even better. It is my experience that leadership at the OIA understand what is expected and are working to make it happen. Unfortunately, however, OIA has already received a disproportionate share of budget cuts during the special sessions. An old friend and mentor of mine tells me that no matter how tough it gets, you don't eat your seed corn, or you won't have any crop at all for the future. I fear that if OIA continues to receive disproportionate budget cuts, they may lose their ability to effectively fulfill their mandate to protect public safety and promote positive youth development. Please do all that you can to keep OIA whole during these difficult financial times. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Seymour. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I stampede to apologize. I've come across a term that I've never, and I should have probably learned it early on in this process, level four. That's a term I really don't understand.
Mr. Seymour.
In our contract with the state of Oregon, we serve kids in the community that are a certain level of risk and behavior management problems that we refer to as level four.
From
goes from one through five.
Five
being the most difficult.
Okay.
If the youth we're proposing to serve would be the level four youth.
Okay. Anything further? Ms. Bodine.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tammy Bodine, and I work with Washington County Juvenile Department, and I'm actually work with probation services. And one of the things, I took some time off today because we work very closely with Oregon Youth Authority, and we do receive a lot of services from Oregon Youth Authority. And I guess with the beginning cuts, we're starting to see a lot of the problems. And in my experience right now, I'm working with a youth who in the last month of March, since some of the state cuts, has stolen a car four different times. And it was like a revolving door. He went into detention, and then he came out a day later, went into detention again after the second time. And each time, the offense got worse. You know, the first time it's a stolen car, the next time it's a stolen car with the DUI, the next time it's eluding police. So we're seeing this happening, and he needs placement with Oregon Youth Authority, obviously. And those are the things that myself and other probation officers with the counties are concerned about, because we work closely with Oregon Youth Authority, and if we don't have the services that they provide, some of the clients that we work with need close custody, and they need that treatment. And if we can't provide it, the county is going to also be powerless on doing anything. So that's what I wanted to say today and let you know that we really need the services that Oregon Youth Authority provides. Thank you.
Put in a real quick question. Is the biggest issue in your opinion right now, then? It seems like that there's not enough custody beds. Is that really a substantial driver in your ability to really we deliver the services on the ground at the county level?
Yeah. Washington County, I think we went from like a 70-something cap to a 40-something, so we lost quite a few beds that we use. We use a lot of the monies for sex offender treatment, and that's something that a lot of the youth, if they don't have treatment in the community, they are committed by our judges. So beds and shelter care beds we lost is also a viable resource that we use that we don't have anymore. So,
thank you.
Mr. President,
about one question. This particular youth who's come back this number of times, using the information that was just from the previous speaker, is that graduating up to a level 4 by any chance, level 3, not to a level 5 yet?
I would say he's probably past level 4, because from my understanding, a lot of level 4 are the out-of-control runaway, not multiple felonies, but this kid obviously continued to do the same thing again and again, and he hasn't received any consequences. So for him, in his mind, he doesn't, if I do it again, nothing's going to happen. I'll sit in detention for one day.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. I'm sorry. I don't want to try and do an analysis on this particular youngster, but how much of that, Ms. Bobadini, do you think maybe as a result of the fact that we've got this budget crisis and they're tuned into it, he's tuned into it, he or she, whatever, is tuned into it, and that act out is exacerbated, and maybe they're really level 2, but they're acting at level 4.5.
Some of that budget, I would say yes, because I don't know how aware he is of the budget, because one of the big problems is that he's a methamphetamine user, so he's just out using drugs, partying, and having a good time. The result of the budget is not to be able to stop him after the first.
He's only aware that he's not suffering the consequences of his actions.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Ms. Beatrice.
Hi. Thank you for providing the public an opportunity to discuss the most serious topic of public safety and subsequent quality life in Oregon. I'm Janine Beatrice, and for the last 4 years I've been a corrections counselor with the Oregon Youth Authority's Corvallis House. It's a young women's transition program serving incarcerated young women ages 14 to 25. I come here as an individual, having worked alongside at-risk youth, mostly women, for about 12 years. In 1999, the Corvallis House opened as the only closed custody women's facility in Oregon that worked with incarcerated young women and their families in the communities where they were going to return to, while reintegrating them back into the communities. The Corvallis House program is the culmination of an agency's dedication, I'm hoping a statewide dedication, to changing how inmates are returned back into the communities. We teach and support young women who have learned to be good, very good inmates, into being community citizens who believe that they belong back out there. We help transform young women who identify themselves as criminals, violent offenders, or institutionalized into young women who replace their labels and start referring to their accomplishments. I graduated from high school. I have a job now. I'm volunteering in the community. Even with the Corvallis Health Program and the invaluable community programs we partner with, these young women face obstacles to succeeding. Long family histories of abuse, neglect, welfare dependence, and criminality. There's no shortage of men twice their age promising them babies and jobs, love and a place to live, all usually for a price. Their personal chemical dependency also threatens their success. Mental illness is a struggle for them, poor social skills, and overall immaturity. Now picture young women facing these same obstacles without programs that aim to help them gain independence. They'll face the same threats, but with no way out, and possibly forcing them to return to former survival skills. My hope is that the decision makers in Oregon will consider the young women that I serve and those in the community that don't really have a whole lot of representation right now. I believe it's a major component of public safety. These are future moms, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beatrice.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, if you know it. Do you know what the experience with recidivism rates have been with Corvallis House since?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I think Karen probably has those.
Yeah, I'm sure.
If you can give those to us.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of statistics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question relative to the Corvallis House itself. Ms. Beatrice, I understand that the top floor, the third floor, is not being utilized. If repairs were made, and I don't know that it's even potential that they could be made, but whatever necessary improvements were being made, and we had the budget to do that, would the balance of the infrastructure of the residents accommodate more than the 25 units that are there now? Bathrooms, kitchen, laundry.
That's a real infrastructure question I don't feel prepared to answer. I'm sure if it was considered safe enough to handle, we could do it.
Okay. So the third floor is used for?
Nothing.
Okay, thank you.
It's not safe.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, all three of you. We made it through the public testimony. We didn't quite get to back to the agency again. So what I'd like to do is try and get the committee here on time tomorrow and try and spend just about 30 minutes on the priority pieces and the questions that we have. Yeah, I want to review on what we were going to review at the beginning of today. We'll do the priority piece, and then we'll be done. So I anticipate it'll take more than about 30 minutes tomorrow. So. All right. With that, we are adjourned.